Hey, this is Zach Quaintance, the writer of The Death of Comics Bookcase, and you are listening to the Oblivion Bar Podcast.
Welcome to the Oblivion Bar Podcast with your host, Chris Hacker, and Aaron Knowles.
Joining us this week on the show is someone many may already know as a well-regarded comic book journalist for popular sites like The Beat and Comics Bookcase. Well, add Comic Book Scribe to his resume because The Death of Comics Bookcase Volume 1 is his recent crowdfunded anthology that, as of this recording, has well over 200 backers and just surpassed $10,000. It is my pleasure to welcome Zach Quaintance onto the Oblivion Bar Podcast.
Hey, how's it going, Chris? Thanks for that intro. I like hearing the where the project's at. Feels good when people say it. So I think that's the first time I've heard someone say it out loud. So
that's right. Which, I mean, it only happened, what, a couple days ago?
Yeah, it's been, I mean, it feels like weeks for me because every day is so packed. But yeah, it's only been like 10 days or whatever.
Sure. Well, Zach, so thank you so much for coming on to the show. I appreciate you coming on to talk about the death of Comics Bookcase. And I wanted to start off the conversation kind of talking about getting, you know, our listeners familiar with not only The Death of Comics Bookcase, but also highlight, you know, your storied relationship with the medium and with the comics industry. So in whatever length that you want to give to our listeners, could you give us a rundown of your career in comics and what you were doing before deciding to take on writing?
So I've been like seriously involved with comics as an industry since about late 2017, early 2018, which is when I launched my my now defunct blog, Comics Bookcase. And before that, I've always been a writer. I was a journalist by trade. I still have a journalist day job and also a lifelong comic book fan. So I decided I kind of wanted to combine the two things and kind of give back to the industry and the medium a little bit. And so I launched a blog in 2018. And then later that same summer, Heidi McDonald, who's run The Beat for 20 years now, this is The Beat's 20th anniversary this year, mm-hmm. put out an all call on Twitter looking for journalists to help cover San Diego Comic-Con that summer. And I said, you know, I have a comics blog. I'm a journalist. I'd love to do this. She got me a pass. I went, I covered it for The Beat, and I kept contributing to The Beat ever since. That went on for a few years. The blog grew. Like, I think at our peak, we were doing pretty well. We were updating four or five times a day, reviewing comics, interviewing creators. And then in 2022, I decided, you know, running your own blog is pretty tiresome. So I'm going to...
Creating in general is super tiresome, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it was, honestly, it was a matter of like, I feel like to do it right, it's like what you all do, like the podcasting, and like you got to be on every platform and everything. And I was just like, man, I don't know those tricks. Like I just kind of want to write. And so I talked to Heidi and I went full time, more so at The Beat. And at the same time, that cleared my schedule massively. And I was finally able to like really hone a lot of the ideas I've been working on and start creating my own comics with my new free time after kind of putting my blog on pause. And now I'm killing that blog.
And that's the story we have here in front of us. Now, I'm curious. So again, you just mentioned a moment ago that you kind of created the Comics Bookcase as a way to celebrate the medium and such. Just kind of broadly, before we get into the death of it, do you miss doing Comics Bookcase at all now?
Sometimes. not. I don't miss the like grind of it. I miss the people I was working with over there. So like, sure. I was working with some really great people on that blog, like Lisa Gullickson from Comic Books. Couples Counseling contributed, and we had a lot of writers that would contribute a few pieces and go on to write for the Comics Journal and Comics XF and all these places. So I got to meet a lot of really cool people who cared a lot about comics and knew about comics I didn't know about. And I miss that part of it a lot. Thankfully, you know, social media and everything exists, and I'm able to keep in touch with most everyone I worked with. Not quite as frequently as I'd like, but more or less.
Yeah. You know, what's funny about comics Twitter, comics, you know, fandoms online in general. I mean, comics Twitter was really fun, and I'm sure you would agree. Maybe, what, 10 years ago, it was really, really fun. And
yeah,
it's kind of, it's still fun. Obviously, if you're on social media for comics, you can still find pockets of fellowship and camaraderie, and you can celebrate things that you love. And to be honest, I think that's actually how we met initially, was not only through social media, but also through Lisa. You know, speaking of Lisa Gullickson,
right. Yeah.
she was one who introduced us through, you know, through the beat. So I'm very thankful for her for that. And it obviously exposed me. I was already familiar with Comics Bookcase, but I, you know, and I've heard you say this in other conversations, that a lot of people referenced you or knew you as Comics Bookcase, or they called you Mr. Bookcase, right?
Mr. Like
that
Bookcase.
Was, yeah, that was kind of your moniker.
Yeah, people would make jokes like, "Oh, that's a great take for a piece of furniture," and I'd be like, "Come on, that's not
come on.
Written by a piece of furniture. I'm a person." But yeah, I was like a character on Comics Twitter a little bit, because I ran the Twitter account for Comics Bookcase, like I'd use the first person, and I'd like it was about my relationship with comics. And it was always a thing of like, I was trying to do it to promote the blog, but I would get a lot of engagement through people who would never dream of clicking on one of the blog links, but they loved to like reply to the tweets and kind of knew me that way. But yeah, I made a lot of friends on there. It was a good time.
This is kind of relevant to, you know, a similar way as the Comics Bookcase and the Oblivion Bar, just podcasting in general, is that, you know, you can have these followings on social media, you can have online friends or what have you, but to get people to actually check out the thing that you're creating behind that account is, and I'm telling everyone listening right now, just so I'm sure most people know this, listening to this right now, that is one of the most difficult things to do.
So hard.
To get people to just click the link and check it out, you know?
Yeah. And it's like, it's especially odd to me, like if you're known to a person because you're talking about comics on social media, and then you're like, "Hey, I did a whole hour conversation on this podcast about comics. You want to listen to it?" And they're like, no, that's not for me. I just want to read these incremental takes." Yeah. It's like, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. Like, just give it a shot. You know, not a lot to ask. It's free also.
I guess that's one of the true downfalls of social media, is that folks will often just like either look at the replies, look at the headline, and then make a snap decision based on that or someone else's uninformed opinion. And that's, you know, that feels like a whole nother conversation that we could get into. And we don't have to today, because I want to spend the majority of our time together talking about the death of Comics Bookcase. And I have a synopsis here. If you don't mind, I'm gonna read that for the listener here. This is the synopsis for volume one. After their camping trip was hit by a thunderstorm, a group of teens wander into a creepy old house, which turns out to be the Comics Bookcase HQ. Inside, they come face to face with a living, speaking, and truly awful Comics Bookcase. He claims he wants to tell them stories, but can they trust him? So, truthfully, my favorite part about reading this first volume of the death of Comics Bookcase is it becomes apparent very quickly that we are in the hands of someone who knows and truly understands the medium. You play around with the inside baseball and the shorthand of reading comics in a way that doesn't alienate those that don't catch those small jokes, but it does give those that do, like us, the warm and fuzzies that we've come to know and love from the medium.
Yeah, I think there's layers to it. Like, like you said, and I appreciate you saying that. Like, if you're not a person who spends all your time thinking about comics, or maybe you're just kind of a casual reader, I think it's a lot of fun with just the story concepts. But I think there's another layer then for people who know comics as a medium really well. There's like nods to certain classic comics and constructs, like the old EC horror hosts. And then there's a third layer, even deeper past that, of jokes for people like us who do their own sites and podcasts and know comics Twitter. So yeah, I think there's like several different layers to engage, and you can go as deep as you want, or you can just read it for the stories. I think it works. I hope it works for all those different groups.
Oh, 100% it does. And I'm curious, just, you know, kind of your temperature check across the board for, you know, followers or just friends or whomever you've had, you know, read the Death of Comics Bookcase. What seems to be kind of the more prevailing popular entry in that anthology?
Oh, the Werewolf Priest is the is the breakout star, I would say. Out of all the stories, that's the one I hear about the most, or the people want to talk about the most. It's the lead story too, so you would hope that that's the one that grabs people and gets them to say like, yeah, I'm in for the whole ride after they read that one. But yeah, like that's the conversation starter. And I'm glad that one has, because that one's kind of constructed to be a series eventually, like a full, we have plans to build it into a full series. So, but yeah, that's the star so far of the couple dozen people who've read the book as of now.
I mean, when you have Anna Redmond on the book, it makes sense, right? And just kind of based on that and, you know, the story itself, did you anticipate that one? And that, is that why you chose that as the first entry in the anthology?
Yeah. You know, it was weird. Like I kind of did the stories read in the anthology in the order I made them. Mm. So there's very chronological into how, like, I just made one after the other and arranged them that way. I never thought twice about, like, maybe I should move this one or that one. But that, if it wasn't for the idea for that story and Anna being willing to work with me on that story, like, the rest of them wouldn't exist. It's like that simple. Because that was the first idea. That was the first one we went all in on doing as a pitch with a backup plan to, like, we didn't want it to be one of those pitches that you hear about where people, oh, we had this great pitch, but no one's ever going to see it because it didn't, for any one of 100 reasons, it didn't go. So we built this backup plan around it while working on that pitch that, like, we were going to put it in this anthology. And I talked to a few editors to make sure, like, hey, if this shows up in an anthology, like, does that disqualify it from being a pitch you'd look at? And they all said no. So it took off from there.
Isn't that what Hellboy? Wasn't Hellboy in an anthology before he eventually came, like Malibu Sun or something like that? I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, it was either that or it was like a short comic they passed out at San Diego, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I shared a thing on Twitter earlier today. For everyone listening right now, we're brand new back on Twitter. We were on for a long time. We hopped off for obvious reasons and then now we're back. But there was a panel I really love, and I won't spoil anything for anybody that hasn't read it yet, but it's kind of a play on a panel you had earlier in the story where it's like Cox News, which is obviously a play on Fox News, and they're doing their normal performative hyperbole. And as our, I'll say our titular villain is attacking, the people that he's attacking says something like, must be a migrant. Oh, on fentanyl, probably trying to vote.
I'm glad you caught that one. Yeah. Cause that's that I was really proud of that joke where there maybe shouldn't be a joke because it's a horror story, but yeah, I couldn't resist kind of doing a callback to the very first page. It's like a callback. Yeah, I'm glad you liked that one. I saw that panel and I was like, hell yeah, somebody got it.
Yeah. And I don't know if I already said this or not, but it is my favorite story in the anthology as well. Of the, you know, what is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 that we have here in this story, the Werewolf Priest is, I think, the one that I am most intrigued by. And of the couple conversations that I've listened to you talk about this, it seems like that, and you already said it too, seems to be the one that people are excited about. And you have active pitches for this. And is it the Gold Mask as well?
Gold Mask. Yeah. Gold Mask is, so the difference between them, the Werewolf Priest is the first 8 pages of a number one issue. Like, well, we have, I've scripted the rest of it. Like, that's basically act one of what would be number one of a, it has a different series name because it's kind of a monster of the week concept. It's not always going to be a Werewolf Priest, but yeah. And then Gold Mask, which is a fantasy comic, is more of a proof of concept, but just kind of an introduction of the character. But there's also like an outline and hope among the entire creative team to eventually pitch that as a series and build that into a fantasy miniseries. I really love that character. I love writing that character, and I love the character design that Luke Horstman did for that. Just doesn't get better. Mm-hmm. It always makes me laugh.
I love it too. Gold Mask was definitely up there. And I don't have a question around this, but I do want to say just briefly that as I was reading this for the first time, The Werewolf Priest, obviously, like I said, was my favorite, but I felt like as I kept going, and you know how anthologies go, sometimes you'll read the first one and it's really good, and then you'll kind of like, just nothing peaks after that, respectfully, of course. I felt like as I kept reading, I found something I liked about every single one. You know, the responsibility, a responsibility, I think it's how you say it. Is basically, you know, kind of a riff on, you know, Amazing Fantasy and early Spider-Man and kind of, but also dealing with like modern AI issues and things like that. The Gold Mask, which is like we just talked about briefly, was a smart mouthed dark mage Gold Mask who finally has infiltrated the Tower of Zacatus. Is that how you say that?
Zacatus.
Yeah. Thank you. And you know, tries to steal a fabled dark artifact. The Next Door 2, which is actually a continuation of another comic that you had done before, correct?
Yeah. It's Next Door was a one shot that I did in 20. It came out in 2021. Also crowdfunded. And this is like a first 10 pages of what would be Next Door number 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wait, and you know, as someone who has not, you know, regrettably has not read Next Door quite yet, I still think that I found a lot of enjoyment in that second part. And if nothing else, it made me more intrigued to want it to eventually check out Next Door number 1.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah. It was built to stand alone. There's like a half a page kind of like where they talk about the events of the first one, but I feel like you can read right past that and just get into the story from the word go. But yeah, that's one we want to do more of as well, obviously.
Yeah. And then the final story is Apes versus Sharks, the Omega Brain 4.
Yeah.
Which, for everyone listening right now, if that sounds insane, it's, I think, kind of the funny premises behind the story is that the Apes versus Sharks is not entirely the central part of this story. Am I fair to say that?
I think that's fair. Yeah. It definitely started as like, that one had a long journey. Like it took me a long time to write that one, and it started as something and became something else. But yeah, it starts with Apes versus Sharks, and it starts with the idea of like, I was making a 48-page comic, and I thought to myself, like, there's just no way I'm going to make a 48-page comic and not have some apes in it. Like, it's like, I've passed the threshold for how many stories I've done without apes, so it's time.
That's right.
But yeah, it ended up being really personal, like surprisingly even to me as I worked on it. I was like, oh man, what am I doing with this? And it's probably the one I'm like most nervous for people to read out of all of them.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting because I think that there are a couple, I would say the Responsibilitine, Gold Mask, I would say parts of Next Door number 2 and Apes versus Sharks. What I really appreciate about all of them and what I think readers will find really interesting as well is that your voice in each of those, I feel like you're able to tell what sort of, I wouldn't say political thoughts you're trying to put out to the reader, but I would say like your moral compass is evident in these stories. And it's not something that I think is overbearing. I don't really believe that you're always going to put, parts of yourself in your work, but like it feels there's this perfect levy of just a good cohesive story. And then there's that slight undertone of, here's a subliminal sort of view as well. I'm sort of spinning my wheels trying to describe it, but I just really appreciated it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, there's not a single one of these stories that I set out to make any kind of point. Like there was not a one of them is built like, I believe this about that and I want to get that across. But what happened with a lot of them is they would start with the high concept, like the really pulpy, like I love pulp comics. I love comics that are fun and kind of wink and are just like a good time. And so the concepts for all of them started that way, whether it was a werewolf priest, a dark mage with a smart mouth, apes fighting sharks, or making a new superhero. Like they all started with the idea of like, let's do something that I personally like about comics. I want to make that kind of comic. And then as I worked on it more and more, I wanted it to be unique to me. Like I was, what can I add here to these things I love? Like, how can I make it my version of a superhero, my version of a horror story, all these different things. And the more personal it became, like these sort of like, I don't think there's really, like you said, you're right. It's not political, but like, it's what I'm feeling about what's happening in the world around me is in all these stories. And like, moral compass, like I think Gold Mask, kind of that story more than anything speaks to my personal moral compass. Like Gold Mask sort of doesn't set out to do the right thing, and like we can like talk about why that makes me shitty or whatever. But like, but he ends up doing it, and then he ends up complaining about it the whole time, and that's how I feel as a person in the world. So that was like found its way into my fantasy story, and I think they all have like there's one about my relationship to AI and the werewolf priest. I was a journalist in South Texas, and that character found its way into that story also. So they all have a little bit. If you know me, you'll probably be tired of me by the end of reading this book.
I disagree. I was intrigued personally. I'll tell everyone, as a first time reader of Zach's work, this is something that I'm definitely, and I know that, the Death of Comics Bookcase Volume 2 is already in production, right? Like it's already, if not production, it's already been like planned, correct?
Yeah. Like I know every story that would be in it. I've outlined it. I have loose notes. When the campaign's done, I'll start scripting. I have artists in mind. And like some of the same characters will come back. Like I'm not entirely like it, like a little bit of it is up to like if the Gold Mask pitch or the Werewolf Priest pitch turn into anything. Like, but definitely I have a title for it. Like, yeah, it's happening. And the better the campaign does, the faster it'll happen. Cause I like to get the comics made ahead of time. I don't want any of the artists to have to work under some promise that like we're going to split the Kickstarter or whatever, because that's no fun to have that uncertainty. So yeah, like the better this does, the faster they'll go right into production and we'll get it out there.
Mm-hmm. Now, with the success that we highlighted there at the beginning in the introduction, over 200 backers, just surpassed $10,000 in terms of like overall support, which is incredible. I mean, I'm curious specifically, is that support for a Kickstarter campaign, specifically a comic book, is that huge? Can you kind of contextualize that for everybody?
I'm not walking away with a ton of money, because it's like making indie comics is expensive. And I aimed high with the artist and had colorists and all these things. But it is really great to get that kind of support. And like, basically at this point, a print run is paid for. I have a little bit of money to start making the next one. And it's like, I just want more backers, because I'm really, really proud of this book. And I want it to be the start of something. Like, I want this to be one of those campaigns that like people follow through all three planned volumes, and it kind of builds and brings in more people, and there's word of mouth and everything. And that was part of the reason too, I wanted to make the whole book ahead of the campaign so that we could get it right to the printer as soon as the money clears, essentially, because my last experience with Kickstarter, I just felt like interest in the book sort of peaks when you're promoting it daily, and then you're exhausted, and then it takes a year or whatever it might take to make it, and then people like get it in the mail and they're like, what is this? Like, I had one guy on Twitter, like, I had these comics bookcase stickers that I were a stretch goal and went out with every issue in Nextdoor. Mm-hmm. And some guy like tagged me on Twitter and was like, I don't know where I got this or what it is, but it's kind of cool. And I'm like, that was what the comic I really cared about. Like, thanks for remembering.
Also, you
that.
Put your credit card down for this, just so you know.
Yeah. You paid money for that. So like, but yeah, that kind of stung and stuck with me. And I was like, well, next time they'll remember where they got that sticker. So,
that's right. Yeah. Well, you kind of alluded to this a moment ago, but it feels sort of like this first volume is, a love letter that's written with a poison tip pen. And what I mean by when I say that is that you obviously love the medium. And as we said earlier, you've been a leading force in terms of analyzing, critiquing it for some time now. But at the same time, you know, you highlight and you poke fun at certain parts of, you know, the typical cliches that comic books are known for in a way that says, like, you know, isn't this silly? You know, like, we all know that this is super silly, right? And my question for you, though, is how much of that is holding up a mirror to the medium and embracing its silliness, or how much of that is you just highlighting the many different tones you think a comic book can juggle at the same time?
I think it's more the latter. Like, I think one of the things I love about comics is the versatility and how it can be something serious, like a graphic memoir about trauma, like with no humor whatsoever. And it can be really, really fun and all humor, and it can be my favorite comics tend to be this like amazing intersection of the two, right? Like, I think Grant Morrison is a writer that does that really well, that sort of like appreciates comics for it being a lighter medium, very accessible and capable of being irreverent, but also can be used to make a serious point and like really kind of get at something honest about yourself you can't say in any way. Like, Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely's Flex Mentallo does that incredibly well, and I'd say that's one of the main inspirations, particularly for the Ape Shark story, where it takes the medium seriously, and obviously you can't make comics of that quality without absolutely loving comics, but it also kind of pokes a little bit of fun at it and the history of it and just like how unique and singular the medium is. And that's what I found myself doing, like, as I kind of got deeper and deeper into this, just having fun with it. But yeah, it's my take on comics, right? Like, I would never tell anyone who like there's people who will refer to a comic as the text. And I've always kind of like, I respect that enough, but I would never refer to a comic as the text. My version is a little lighter.
that implies, I think, and I agree with you 100%. I think like that implies that the text, the continuity is ever important, and that we should stick to it, and that we shouldn't use the flexibility of continuity, but we should stick to it as like a Bible in a way, right?
Yeah. Like, it's just so permanent and serious sounding, like an academic paper or like a religious document. I don't know. Like,
yeah.
It's never felt like quite right to me to like take comics that seriously, but I respect people who do. And I know some people think like, oh, well, we'll never be taken that seriously as a medium if we don't like really kind of buy into like, but I think there's room for everything. Like, and like I said, that's the versatility of it and the way it can cover that whole spectrum is the thing I really love about comics in particular. And the way, like, some of my favorite creators who make the most serious kind of high-minded comics, I'll see them on social media reading just total goofy stuff and loving it, you know, like, and I love when that happens.
Yeah. You got Tom King posting pictures of him reading, you know, the Peanuts or whatever, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, and I love what you said there a moment ago, and I agree 100%. I can't remember who said this exactly, but I think it went something to the effect of like most mediums, you know, we'll say like prose novels or what have you, are written in permanent marker, but comics are written in dry erase. So in a way that, and I think what they meant by that is that there's a flexibility to the medium that a lot of others don't, right? Like, if you read a Batman story from Grant Morrison and a Batman story from Tom King, they're probably wildly different, right? And that also speaks to the flexibility of the character of Batman, but also you can do that with a lot of different characters, you know?
I mean, yeah, I just think, yeah, there's just something inherent to the way, like, making comics is really labor intensive and takes a long time. And like, I think as they're being made, like, you, new ideas can occur to you in a way that other storytelling mediums, where like you kind of finalize a script for a television show, it goes into production and it's locked in. Mm-hmm. Don't, like, you can, like, I mean, you're rewriting, you're doing lettering passes. Like, like some of the jokes in the framing sequence were 100% at it after colors came back. Like, and I was reading it for the, looking through these pages for the eighth time, and like new things were still popping and occurring to me just because of the process being that long. And it doesn't strain the credibility of a story that was already about a talking bookcase that had one more joke in there, right? Like,
yeah. Which of these entries do you think has been the most, like, I wouldn't say grueling, but the one that's been the most challenging, I guess you would say?
The two that were, like, for me as a creator, the two that were hardest to write were The Responsibilitine and Apes Versus Sharks. Like, those ones really were labor intensive for me. They both have a little bit of metafiction. And I think there was a bit of, like, walking in big footsteps at play there. Like, those are probably the two I'm most nervous about as well for people to read. But yeah, those ones took a lot of work. And I was also really nervous about bringing both of those artists on to make sure that they were kind of like in sync with the way we were playing with some of the ideas there. So yeah, those two were the ones that really took the biggest toll on me as a writer, definitely.
Sure. Yeah. And just for everyone that's aware, is everyone listening right now, the Responsibilitine, Art and Letters and Colors by Nick Cagnetti. Is that correct there? And then was it the Apes Versus Sharks was artist PJ Holden, who maybe a lot of people might know from Judge Dredd. So yeah, and both are great too. And it's interesting that you say those two are your most challenging, because I feel like as I look at the five entries of The Death of Comics Bookcase, those two stand out to me as maybe the most impressive.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to hear you say that.
100%. I mean, again, I already said that The Werewolf Priest is my favorite, but I think that alludes more to my taste in comics. I love sort of the noir-y detective horror type of storyline, you know. But I will say that The Responsibilitine, I won't say that like people who have never read comics can enjoy this. They absolutely can. But I think if you are familiar with the medium and you speak that language, you're going to get a kick, like a true kick out of this Responsibilitine. And I know at one point you even have a moment where you point at the writer. You're talking like almost to yourself. And that meta, like you were saying a moment ago, is cycling through as you're reading it. So and then, of course, like I said, the Apes Versus Sharks, the apes and the sharks are sort of a foreground, you know, setting. Like, they're like not really the true pillar of the story. It's more so the character that has control of the Omega Brain. And I don't want you to have to try to explain the story to me. Obviously that's part of the journey of reading it and also creating it. But like, my view of the story was that anytime that our main character needed to escape from reality, he would use the Omega Brain and it would take him directly back into this wild world of Apes Versus Sharks. But they also wanted something from him as well, you know? And I think that speaks to how, like, when you become a comic fan, and I'm going to speak broadly here. This obviously isn't ever the case of everyone, but I think from the folks that I know, there aren't people who just kind of read comics. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they read, they are a Wednesday warrior. They read comics. They listen to comic book podcasts. They go to see every single MCU film. You know, they have a pull list maybe at one or two places. Like, it's all of that, right?
Definitely. 100%. It's for people like that. And it, for me, I also think that not only are you in that deep, but it tends to like be a thing that you can't shake. Like, you might come out of it a little bit, but it always sort of pulls you back. It's like, if, especially for those of us, I feel like, who kind of got into it as kids,
sure,
and have like really positive young memories of it, I think that there's just always a part of you that's kind of locked into comics. Like, at least the way I engaged with it as a kid, like I during college or right after college, like, maybe didn't have as much money to read comics or time or just like other things I was involved in, and would step away a little bit, but it was always there with me. And I was always wondering what was going on and always coming back. So like, yeah, that was a big part of it, is just kind of like saying like, this has been my relationship to comics. And then the other side of that coin is like, plus I really love apes and comics.
As we've said, as we've highlighted earlier in the conversation,
there's one thing I've established here on this show. It's my love of comic book apes.
Like, did you see that DC did some kind of like ape month or ape?
April did I see Fools it? Yeah, something? I read it.
I can't remember what it was.
It was April.
April. There it was.
It was just an anthology of ape stories.
that's going on. Did you put in a pitch for that or no?
No.
Maybe next year?
Maybe next year. I'm sure it'll be a huge hit and they'll do it every year now. So.
Right. Well, I wanted to kind of briefly go back just a moment where we were just talking about there in terms of like what I find so interesting. And I think the reason why, or part of the reason why I love the medium so much is that you can hand someone, you can have two folks in front of you. You can have a 6-year-old and a 6-year-old and you can hand them Spider-Man Blue, you know, by Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale.
Oh yeah.
And I guarantee you, they're both going to take out wildly different things from that book. That sort of speaks to the flexibility of the medium, as we were just talking about a moment ago, and how as a kid, you can read Spider-Man and go, man, I love, you know, his suits. I love his powers. I love his villains. That's
He's
all
funny.
Great. He's funny. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. All the, like, and you can like power fantasy, like sort of power fantasy your way into the POV of Peter in those stories. As an adult, what I think makes Spider-Man so compelling is that he can't be happy. If he is happy for more than 10 minutes, something will happen. Aunt May will die.
Right.
MJ will break out with him. You know, something will happen. And
you, fired. Yeah.
Or yeah, he gets fired from the Daily Bugle, something like that. And I think that speaks to the, you know, the power of comics is that you remember as an adult that there are adults are making this, they're putting themselves into these stories and yeah, they're accessible for all ages. But I love the fact that you can do all that with one medium. You can't hand a 12-year-old Game of Thrones, most of them. You can't hand
most
of them. Yeah, you absolutely should not. But, you know, you could hand, you know, a 12-year-old, you know, for instance, like, I don't know if this is really appropriate. I don't really know what I think is appropriate for young people anymore because they have the entire world of violence and anger in their hands at all times.
Yeah.
But you can hand them, you know, you can hand them Watchmen. And I guarantee you, and that's a book that I read. I see on your shelf right behind you. That's a book I read every couple of years and pick up something new every time I read it.
Yeah. It's like listening to the Beatles in a way. Like, like you read Watchmen when you're 12 and you like different parts of it. You read it when you're 18 and you like different parts of it. You read it when you're 25 and you like still different parts of it. Yeah. And that's a really great point. One of the books I was reading as I was working on these comics was Astro City by Kurt Busiek and Brent Anderson, which were comics that I had read as a kid and had liked. I was like, I just want to see different versions of superheroes that seem kind of familiar to me. That's great. And then I was rereading them last summer into the fall, and just like really appreciating the complexity of the human characters, the like smaller people in it. And I think that speaks right to that point. That's like comics has this ability to offer different things to different generations and to have that rereadability to a lot of it as you kind of grow and take new things away from some of these stories.
100%. Well, Zach, I have one final question for you here, and it has to do with sort of making the leap into the world of writing. And obviously you've been doing the writing for a while, but I guess I'm speaking specifically about the world of writing comics, you know.
Sure.
And many of us, you know, suffer from imposter syndrome and either don't know or can't make that emotional leap to at least attempt to write a script or reaching out to potential collaborators. So asking for a friend who may or may not possibly be in this recording studio currently, what was your very first step in that process of creating stories and then putting in the back end work to make them real and then eventually having the courage to share them out into the world?
It's hard. It's a great question because it is hard. Like the very first step was during the pandemic, a friend of mine, Pat Scott, who's an artist, reached out to me and was like, hey, I'm home on quarantine. Do you want to write a 5-page comic? And I was like, yeah, let's do it. You know,
sorry, my schedule's busy. I don't have a lot of time, but sure.
Right. And that's sort of how Nextdoor had started. But the only reason he reached out to do that was because I'd been tweeting, like I was working on scripts for other things. So I'd already taken that first step to just kind of set aside 30 minutes to an hour a night after work to kind of just play with scripting comics and to read. I had, and it's a book I saw on your shelf earlier, the hardcover of The Vision.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And if you look in the back of that, there's script pages side by side with finished art. And so you can kind of see how the script led to the art. And so I had that book and I had a couple others that had that kind of script material in it. So I was just reading those and I was just spending that 30 minutes to an hour every night, like discipline, like something like you would if you were working out, you know, just making myself sit down to do this and try to have fun with it. And it wasn't fun at first. Like it's hard work. And then kind of sticking with it. But there's different levels. Like, so I made that first comic. And after that happened, it took me a while to like kind of figure out what my next move was. And it just, like, I think if you really want to do this, it'll keep coming back and keep coming back, and you'll just feel incomplete. Like, you have to do this, or you're not going to be happy. And so, like, yeah, I guess my advice around that is, like, start writing, find an artist or a friend, try to do something small. Like, you'll see people who come on Kickstarter with their first project and be 150 page graphic novel, the first to five. And it's like, I don't recommend that.
That's not a good idea.
Yeah, that's ambitious, sure, but save that after you've made some short comics. And Brian Bendis will talk about this a lot. Like, just make a comic. You can do it with stick figures. You can do it learning to draw very crudely. You can do it with a friend, whatever. Like, just try your hand at it and get going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you ever feel any of that type of, I'm sure you have, but, you know, just out of curiosity, you know, feeling that imposter syndrome and, you know, what was kind of like your way of jumping over that in some way? I know I'm kind of, it's kind of a broad question, but
no, I did 100%. You know what really helped? Getting off social media, like taking a social media break. And sure. Like, while I was working on Werewolf Priest, I was barely on social media. Like, and it's like, it's kind of hurt me with marketing this campaign, to be totally honest with you. Cause I feel like there's people who backed my first campaign. We were like Twitter buddies, and like I disappeared on them in a way, like, and mm-hmm. I get that. And so they're not as excited about this project, but I had to do it. Like, there was that imposter syndrome, like, cause you'll see people on there every day working on really cool stuff, like impossibly cool stuff. Like, here's a new cover, here's new art, here's what I'm pitching. And it just like, it all becomes a little intimidating after a while, this like deluge of like, all this cool stuff that everybody seems to be working on and Kickstarters are rolling out, and you don't know how you're going to get to that point. Things happened on Twitter. Like, you guys left, you know what was going on. Like, it made it much easier to step away. Like, I was going to probably step away anyway, but that really helped, not being on social media, to overcome imposter syndrome and just kind of working on things in a vacuum and having a few very close friends, like my buddy, Harrison Stewart and Easton DiVerna, who are both comic creators. I was in touch with them the whole time while I was working on this stuff, running ideas by them, like having that kind of a close circle of people rooting you on and being like, yeah, this is cool, maybe reconsider this. Like, that was the other thing that really helped me kind of overcome any kind of imposter syndrome or like just being intimidated by the task, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know why. And again, I'm speaking from a friend here that's in the room with us right now. It's not me.
Yeah.
It's definitely not me. It's somebody that's with us right now. I don't know why, but when I think, oh, I'm sorry. When they think that, you got to write a script for a comic, like, you got to like be Alan Moore for some reason. Like, you got to be this like 7-layer deep subtext of just all these different elements. You're talking about God and the universe, and you're also writing a compelling Swamp Thing story all at the same time. And you don't have to do that. I keep telling this person that I know that's in the room with us that's not what you're supposed to do.
Well, tell your friend, like, one thing that helped me with that was I tried to do one cool thing every other page, like to have one really cool thing, whether it was like in Next Door, there's a sequence of where time passes through three panels and they're like, it's a character on the phone and she's having the same progressive conversation. So the first panel, it's clearly summer, the next panel, it's fall, the next panel, it's winter, you know? Yeah. And I was like, this is a cool thing you can only do with comics. Like, so rather than try to like sum up God, that's what I did. I tried to every other page or so, or like every so often I'd be like, you know what? Even if this story is not working, people don't like it, at least I have this cool thing like that I'm kind of proud of and I think is a little bit clever.
Yeah. Just
tell your friend that. I think that helps.
I'll let him know. Well, Zach, thank you so much for joining me here today on the Oblivion Bar podcast. The campaign ends on May 2nd. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. Midnight on May 2nd.
Midnight on May 2nd. The Death of Comic Book Case Volume 1. Everyone, make sure you, if you're listening right now, please check out the link in our show notes to back this incredible anthology. I honestly cannot implore people to do that enough. And Zach, I'll speak to you here personally. You and what your artists have done here with the Death of Comic Bookcase is something that many of us, as we've talked about, we've all dreamed of it, you know, and you're doing it. You're freaking doing it right now. And just giant congratulations from Aaron and I for the wild success that is not only this campaign, but also the book, because it is excellent.
Thank you. No, I really appreciate that. I hope people who love the medium as much as you all clearly do with your show and how great of a job you do with it. Like, if I inspire any of you to make comics, man, what a great legacy that would be for this project.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Well, Zach, I'm going to pass the baton off to you one last time. Is there anything that you want to plug out? I mean, it could be Death of Comic Book Case, or it could not be. Anything you want to plug, any socials to highlight before we let you go?
you can find me on Blue Skies at Quaintance. I'm probably a little more active on there than anywhere else. Comics Bookcase on Twitter is always keep that around to promote whatever my next project is. And then if you really want to make sure you don't miss what I'm up to, if you go to comicsbookcase.com, you can still sign up for the newsletter there. Mm-hmm. And I use that sort of now to update people very sporadically on what I'm writing and when I have new projects. But other than that, please back the project. Last thing I'd like to say is all these artists are absolutely amazing. Like, there would be no book without them. And them being willing to work with me on this is an incredible honor. So shout out to each and every one of them.
What you've done over the last, I'd say, 2 weeks or so in terms of promoting this book is incredible. You know, you have been tenacious, I guess, is maybe the best word to say in terms of the way you post about it, which is incredible.
I'm an amateur. The master is David Pepos. He's the guru. Like, he's the one. If you want to know how to promote a comic book, look at David Pepos. Like, he's an inspiration. And actually, before I started, he was the first one I knew who did comics press, who went into making comics. And so, like, he's been an incredible resource and incredible help. Like, I've asked him so many questions, and I've asked him, like, hey, is it harder to get taken seriously as a creator if you've done press? And he's just been great. Like, it has been rigorous, all the promotion, and it never stops. But, like, that guy, man, like, that guy's everywhere promoting Space Ghost right now, like, twice as hard as I'm promoting this. So, like, but yeah, that's where I learned that.
I know we're kind of winding down the conversation, but it sort of feels like we're all just trying to add our love letter into the medium. We're trying to, like, highlight what's great about the medium in some way or another. And it sort of feels like the modern, or at least it seems more apparent or more apt to happen now, the natural progression as, like, a podcaster, a journalist, someone who loves comics, and that's where you start. And eventually, if you either find yourself with the know-how or the right person or just the ability, you will make your way into actually writing the physical comics themselves.
Yeah, I mean, two things. I think comics it demands your participation at a certain point. Like, there's a long history of, like, people who start in fan press and, like, just want to do it themselves. And the barrier to entry is not as high as something like writing an entire novel or making a whole movie. And then, yeah, like, now I think it's harder than ever to, like, break in or to, like a lot of the traditional channels for, like, pitching to a publisher, getting on at a publisher. It's like the market's in a bit of a downswing. It's just hard. It's really difficult to kind of break in the way you traditionally think of it, but it's easier than ever to have a webcomic or crowdfund. So, like, I think that's another thing that's, like, really opened up the path to go from, like, and if you have the, like, DIY spirit of doing your own podcast or blog, it's a very similar skill set to, like, promoting your own crowdfunder or webcomic. So, like, it kind of, like, opens doors for you that way, that you've done this. Like, I wouldn't know you, I wouldn't know Lisa, I wouldn't know half the people who I've talked to without having done Comics Press.
Sure. So. Well, friend in the room listening right now, you hear that? You can do it. So, and everyone listening right now to this conversation, you can do it as well. If you like what Zach has done here with the Death of Comics Bookcase, just know that he's been where we are. So make sure that if he can do it and doing as well as he has thus far, that gives everyone a little bit more confidence in themselves. So, Zach, once again, I want to thank you for coming on the Oblivion Bar podcast. And, you know, down the road at some point, I'd love to have you back on for, you know, the Death of Comic Book Case Volume 2, or just whatever you're working on at that time.
Yeah, anytime, man. This was a blast. I'd love to come back.
Awesome. All right. Thank you, Zach.
Thank you.